afternoon, considering about all the cell propulsion sources currently available on Delta One. It is 3:03 p.m. on Tuesday, April 6, 2021, in Davis, 106. Members present are Representative Brox, Representative McCarty, Representative Snyder, Boutier, Representative Fields, and myself, Representative Zaleski. But the record is like that they are required to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Time to take care of the representative's problems and standards. Before we begin, I would like to thank Martha Moore, the Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Alex Dunsack, for the original letter we sent in the committee today. Today, we will be doing an overview of the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact. Our testifiers today include Nicole Romano, Executive Vice President of the Alaska Federation of Business, Nicole Marcus, President and CEO of the Association of the Council of Province, and finally, Brittany Matthews, Tribal Government and Justice Director at the Matthews Conference. I also like to note that we have Director Kim Lee, an Acting Deputy Director of Pam Hallman from the Office of Human Services, also on the line and available for questions. We'd like to extend our sincere appreciation to all of you for joining us here this morning as well. So let's go ahead and begin with Nicole Baronio from the Office of Legislative Leaders. Ms. Baronio, if you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, sir. So from the Office of Legislative Leaders, I am the Executive Vice President and General Counsel. In addition to that, I also have the honor and privilege of serving as the contract facilitator for the Alaska Child Welfare Compact. I'm happy to appear today on behalf of both the tribes and the state in a neutral capacity. That's my charge in this role as it relates to the compact, and give you an update on where we are in terms of the compact and where we hope to go in the future. And I understand Katie has agreed to be my star operating ahead again the slide deck, so we'll proceed straight to the first slide. All right, we're going to start with basics. Some of you have had the opportunity to hear this presentation, but others will be your very first time, so you want to make sure that everybody is on the same page as to why the work began before we talk about what exactly the compact is. So when we look at our child welfare system here in Alaska, we noticed a couple of reasons as to why we need a tool like the compact. The first is being significant disparities. As policymakers, you've heard these statistics, so it shouldn't be alarming to you, but Alaska Native children make up about 15% of the state's general population. However, unfortunately, that number is up to 60% of the kids in custody in different regions of the state. Disparities of this nature generally indicate a system failure, and Alaska is no exception. The second reason that this work began around the compact is retention difficulties. The Office of Children Services had a very difficult time recruiting and retaining a prospective workforce. OCS typically operates around a very high vacancy rate right now because of the pandemic. I remember they understand it's upwards of 50% in some regions. And this requires frontline workers to take on caseloads that is more than 3 times the national average. This is a very difficult agency to man, and part of that is because of the task that they are charged to do. So it's really no fault of OCS, but these are some of the reasons that a tool like the compact was developed. Next slide, please. The compact, though, did not start from scratch during the Walker administration. Rather, this has been an ongoing 25-year partnership between state and tribal representatives who form the State Tribal Collaboration Group. These are the folks that have been in the trenches and have developed those relationships, had the difficult conversations, and tried to figure out a way that both the state and tribes could collaborate better around the topic of child welfare. The goals of that collaboration group is to strengthen Alaska's compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act, and also to reduce the disproportionality of Indian children in state custody, and again to build and strengthen those working relationships. It's important that we give credit to the state and tribal collaboration group But what also has statements in the title will for e-agreements. For e refers to a specific section of the Social Security Administration Act. So when you hear for e, that bird comes from. And what these agreements do is they provide resources to states and tribes that operate foster care programs, as well as transitional independent living programs, guardianship assistance, and adoption assistance. Whenever you see that word resources as policymakers, you know that that's also code for money. So these 4E agreements are beneficial to the state in terms of how much money they're able to bring in and therefore free up resources from the general fund. Important to note, if you don't already know, the tribes receive a much higher reimbursement rate under the 4E agreements than the state does. And this again results in significant savings to the state of Alaska. But these 4E agreements should be encouraged to the maximum extent possible, whether or not they're in financial difficult times or otherwise. Next slide, please, Kate.
As we transition to the next slide, I'd just like to note that Representative Perkins is on the line.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now we'll get into talking about what exactly the compact is. In the simplest sense, this is an intergovernmental agreement between the state of Alaska and 18 either federally recognized tribes or their respective tribal organizations. The goal is to improve the outcome of the lives of Alaska children who are in state custody, and that is going to be accomplished through that compact by negotiating which services and supports the tribal co-signers, which is what we refer collectively to the tribes and the tribal organizations are, which OCS services and supports they will take over on behalf of the state. Again, the goal here with the contract is to provide higher quality services at a lower cost. And again, we think that that is done by a transfer of self responsibility and accountability as well to the tribes and the state. Next slide, please. The state tribal health welfare compact is modeled after contracts that the federal government routinely negotiates with tribes and tribal organizations under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. We did not invent the concept of welfare ourselves. In fact, we took what was good in working on the federal health side and borrowed what we liked and liked what we didn't like, as we say, as we put the compact together. So there is precedence in this work, just so everyone is familiar with that. However, our compact here as it relates to child welfare, is historical because it's the very first time that the state has borrowed that federal model and applied it to child welfare or any other services that the state provides. So we are making history appear in Alaska through the compact. Additionally, very importantly, the compact does recognize the inherent authority of tribes to provide child welfare services for their members. Tribes can sometimes be an uncomfortable word, but really what we encourage state policymakers to do is to think of tribes as local governments because that's what they are. In a lot of villages in rural Alaska that don't have a strong local government because there aren't resources. So we'll always be tribe in those communities. So we don't want anyone in the room to be uncomfortable when applying the term tribal sovereignty or tribal sovereignty or tribal authority. This is really just another way to say local control. Next slide, please, Kate. This is a list of all of the 18 co-signers who have signed on to the compact. The big takeaway from this slide is that although there are 18 signatories, there are actually 161 tribes represented. That means this compact has reached all the way down to 169 different Alaska Native villages in rural, far-flung areas of the state that are participating in the compact either as a direct co-signer, such as the Indian tribe, or participating through the regional nonprofit, such as the Inuit Association. So this has a much broader impact than just the 18 co-signers that have signed on to the compact. Next slide, please. Implementation of the where, excuse me, in calendar year 2017, that resulted in the first scopes of work and the funding agreements being signed that fall in FY18. What the tribes did with their state allocation is they either dissolved the child welfare program and this is outward, or if they were operating a child welfare program and they wanted to redesign certain aspects of it based on the compact's authority and funding through the compact, they did that as well. It was really hard to build capacity and infrastructure, or to start building that capacity and infrastructure, of course, this can't be done in just half of one fiscal year, but this was the intent of really the funds that came in that year. Another highlight of the work in FY18 is that the state began to share the PSRs. Those are the protective service reports, whether or not they're screened in or screened out. This has been information that the tribes have sought for decades, but was not able to be shared before the SIL Act because of confidentiality statutes and privacy, which all of the parties to the compact agreed is very important. But what the tribes want to do through the compact and what the state supports is a lot more prevention work. So if the tribes believe that if they know one of their families or one of their members, their children, are in danger of physical harm, they want to be able to reach out much sooner for background services before the child has been removed and placed in state custody. So that's one of the really great aspects of the work in FY18. In FY19, the tribes began to perform initial bulletin relative searches. This is where these involved frontline workers started to research who the child's relatives are, if they were going to be removed and placed into state custody. And the tribes and the tribal and the state partners also initiated four additional scopes of work. Scopes of work is a term of art that is unique to the compact, and it just details the different services that the tribes perform on behalf of the city. The other negotiated scopes of work you can see over there were ongoing relative searches, family contact, licensing assistance, safety evaluations. Around the same time that we had an election, and as a result, the compact was put on hold. It wasn't terminated in any respect, whether or not they made an administration, but the governor did want to have an opportunity to come in and reassess the work and what had been done and reevaluate what his administration's commitment to the compact was going to be. So they were in a bit of a holding pattern for FY19, if you will. And FY20,
in fiscal year 18, second bullet, state plans to protect their service reports and provide training and technical support. Okay, that's fine. But then you said the tribes wanted to do more prevention work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a good thing, but legally, is the tribe doing that work on the behalf of the state, or is this kind of extra credit work on, like, in some other organization that might help somebody out? Or is it legally, are the tribes legally representing the state?
In prevention work, no, the tribes are not legally representing the state, but they're definitely not like an NGO or a religious organization either that is doing this. I'm purely out of it, it's a very hard. Because the tribes are sovereign entities, they have the ability to provide services to their members, whether they be adults or minors. So a lot of the tribes operate different self-governance programs, and whether or not they operate a full-fledged child welfare department, they all have self-governance departments. And some of them do use funds that is not provided by the state to help families that may have identified as high priority families in need of services that can help them become more stable if they're on the verge of experiencing some type of crisis. But the prevention work is not paid for by the state of Alaska whatsoever because the state doesn't
Contact.
It is really exciting to see Alaska making history in this really constructive way. And see federal organizations taking the lead in solving a really sticky problem. I wonder if you can describe the difference between the scopes of work that were sort of drafted or negotiated in FY19 but not signed, and then what was signed in FY20.
Whatever.
representative of our class, I think sometimes their mental goal, state of goal, sometimes they, when it comes to trying to compact, it will be because there are federal resources associated with tribes. Sometimes that can be misinterpreted as doing that work at no cost. In terms of talking about the implementation deadline, can you articulate what was funded by the state for the implementation, returning back to page 7 in fiscal year 18, and contrast that to what was set aside in the subsequent fiscal years?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. The state has consistently funded the compact at roughly 1.5 bits. That's an average. On the high end, it's been about 1.6. On the low end, it's been about 1.2 million. But traditionally, the state has been about in that 1.5 million dollar pocket. And where that amount comes from is that's the amount that all of the 18 tribal groups I have said that it would cost them to hire one full-time equivalent employee to run its program. The tricky part is that even though the amount is made the same financially since the contract was signed in FY18, the tribes have routinely taken on more responsibility at the annual negotiations. So they're doing more scopes of work, but the state is not committed to bringing more resources to the table at this point.
Outlining if that was one of the reasons why, or if there were other reasons for fewer goals.
tools for including participation and including the number of cuts.
Thank you for that question, Madam Co-Chair. The answer is pretty great, so I will keep it short. We did not have one of the regional nonprofits sign on to this. The Cognac Area Native Association did not sign on to the contract. And if you ever tried to do that either because they were not happy with the way that the tribal sovereign immunity permissions in the contract were drafted.
Discussion of multi-year contract and agreed that fiscal 17, which would be really important, I think, for tribes as well as for employees to generate, you know, maybe leading other people employment or other responsibilities to take on these new responsibilities.
Absolutely, we're very excited to share that has been discussed in the caucuses for sure. And one of the models that the tribes are looking at is the millennial challenge. At the federal level, those are 5-year contracts to third world and developing countries that are negotiated at the federal level. And the 5-year cycle really does allow them to do the work versus gearing up for one annual negotiation after another negotiation after another. So that is a possible, very good suggestion and a good solution to hopefully turning the corner on some of this as if the tribes and the state could get to that transfer of services versus continuously gearing up for one annual funding negotiation after another. Thank you, Representative Corbett, through the chair. You're just a little bit off the screen, and I think that's you on Friday. I'm assuming that's you. That's because those two tribes declined to sign, even though they're contract signers, they signed the umbrella agreement, they have not signed the corresponding FSFA, the services support funding agreement aspect of it. That's really the power to perform these folks, and that's because of the sovereign immunity challenges and the way that they view those different provisions. So you're correct. TSA did not sign on to do any of the scopes of work, and neither did the task of the regional council, but they continue to stay engaged as co-signers to the overall contract. And the hope is that through the regional nonprofit government related association and others, that they will come to the table and begin to pay out some of these services.
Thank you, Ms. Bernier. I think we were just finished on the 5-minute before we went to the answer questions. So please continue.
Okay. So just to wrap up on the KC story, this is not a one-time funding opportunity within their grant. They have been dedicated to consultants to the contract. This has been mutually beneficial to both the state and the tribes because both of those individuals have a long and extensive history of working in child welfare. One of them is Francine Henny Jones. She really built and ran Sacred Heights child welfare program for many decades. And the other is Christy Swanson, who is arguably a leading expert on Title IV programs in the state. And she was with the Office of Children's Services until she retired. Both of those individuals are now in contract with Kids and Family Programs and supporting the contract in a neutral role and figuring out where those implementation challenges are going to be more of a challenge and it's kind of get relief from the different scopes of work and really able to identify a lot of sought-out measures and solutions to the problems of implementation. So we're thankful that KC has continued to invest its attention and its resources in the contract and look forward to a more relationship with them as well. And when KC is speaking to the final slide, so these are the long-term goals of the contract, as shared by both the state and the tribal co-signers. They want the rest of children and families to be served locally and as close to home as possible. They want services to be provided in a reasonable cost
for your presentation today in this program or for the development of the new address. Does anyone have a question?
Can we get a copy of the contact for the material is on the different components on it?
Absolutely. It was on OCS's web page at one point, but we will make a note to go ahead and get it out to your office.
I do have a couple of follow-up questions. Since there's a little bit of questions on the handle in the queue. Can you speak to the percent, with the percent increase that you can articulate, Nicole, in terms of work burden on tribes from the compact between the expanded scope of work that the current between FY18 and FY20?
Thank you for that question. It's hard to put an average on all of the different co-signers because they're not all equal. Some of the co-signers have, you know, upwards of 135 children in custody. Others have just a small handful. Some have very well-established child welfare programs. Others are just standing up for child welfare programs. So that might be a better question for Vivian Perkins when she's in the queue, or even perhaps for the average from TCC, I would just be taking in a STEM in the dark and trying to progress to build and more proficient child welfare providers and just also refer to them.
Thank you. And the follow-up question, with your background as an attorney, can you speak to legal requirements that exist in the state of Alaska in terms of ensuring equitable outcomes for children in the foster care system, particularly the Alaska Native children disproportionately represented in the system?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The state of Alaska has a constitutional obligation to all children in the child welfare system, not just Alaska Native children, but there does seem to be a disproportionality issue as the data shows, and the state does have some big challenges in terms of how it overcomes those hurdles, especially when most of the children that are coming into state custody are doing so from rural areas, and then they're being placed into urban homes. A lot of times they're on native homes, trying to reunify that family becomes all the more hard. So the legal obligations, though, that are perhaps a bit heightened for Alaska Native children, those come from the Indian Child Welfare Act. Now, that act is specific just for Native children that meet the definition of Indian under ICWA, and the state does have to go above and beyond in terms of trying to reunite an Indian family and to really show steps of reunification that perhaps aren't there for all children in Alaska. But the thing about ICWA is that it really should be embraced as the gold standard for all children, whether or not they're native or Hawaii. This is what we should be doing as a state, trying to reunite families and to keep them healthy and to keep the children safe as well. So there are specific legal requirements for Alaska Native children who may enter state custody once both are federal through the federal law and not anything on the state grid.
Thank you. And a follow-up question. Does cognizance of the significant disproportionality that you spoke to with regard to Alaska Native children in state custody increase the state's exposure to potential liability?
I believe that that's I do believe that that question is answered if you look at the judgments that have come out because of the number of Alaska children in state custody. The state routinely settles OCS cases for hundreds of thousands, if not up into millions of dollars. So by investing, we think in terms of partnerships with tribes to avoid children entering the system versus being out for a horrific act against state controls like that forever is the better use of state money, especially in kind of critical times.
How would you measure the success of the compact? I think there's a lot of discussion in an environment of decreased state spending to have data points to reflect back on in terms of the success of any state spending impact that the conduct is having within Alaska, and then can you give us a sense of how that information may be gathered or monitored?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as the facilitator, what our personnel is looking in terms of the success of the contract is who's still on the co-signer list at the annual negotiations. Are there any empty chairs, whether it be on the state side or on the tribal side? And if we still have all 18 co-signers there at the table ready to negotiate and stay led by the right people, then I think that's by far the best metrics that we can have at this point. I do tend to be very protective of both the state and the tribes when it comes to data points, because we really are on the cutting edge of our policy. And I can't say that enough. I can't say it more plainly than that. And when we're trying to transform a system that is under this much disparity in numbers and the health challenges that OCS faces, it's going to take time. And so if we have expectations on our state to just overwrite as the tribes all this access to their databases and not have them completely tied up and transfer those cases and not have the tribes waiting and completely tied up to take them on, then that will make an even bigger setback. So in my mind, as long as we have the negotiators there and they're ready to get to work and work through a lot of these really difficult situations, that's a good data indicator at this point. That said, there is going to have to be an infusion of state resources if the state wants this contract to grow. Otherwise, it's going to die of some of the people that are on the line if we don't put some real resources into the contract.
Thank you. A couple of questions for Representative Park and then Representative McCarthy.
Thank you, Chair. The state resources that you say need to be put into the contract, would it be fair to say it would be just a redirection of resources from whatever the state's doing now to whatever the tribes would be doing now?
I don't know if I have to say it answer. I was going along well to answer that question. Representative, that's what I meant. OCS doesn't traditionally ask for more money for the contract. They just reallocate some of the resources in their budget. That said, if the legislature wants to give OCS more money for this, I think I can speak from Director Gordy's issue. How will we get those resources?
Applies to Native families relative to other families, or what is the difference? How is that disparity generated? Is it in response afterwards?
Thank you for that question. The disparity to be, again, quite frank here is really in poverty. And when you have poor families that have a difficult time putting food on the table, clothes on their children's backs, you are going to have other stressors that wealthy families quite frankly don't have to contend with. So that's a tie too that needs to be further examined and really addressed. But until we address poverty, we're going to be seeing it pop up in other situations, like how many children enter the state's custody from Native homes.
Okay. That's what you're saying there. I guess that makes sense. It strikes me as sensible that if children that they end up, first question, I guess, do they end up, children legally end up in state custody or tribal custody? Is this sovereign
sense to me that if the people that are helping the children are culturally closer to those children, they're going to increase the odds of a positive outcome. That makes it the part of not understanding are custody and the liability parts, that if, and the relationship of sovereignty as opposed to the contractor with the state. It looks like it's supposed to be the contract and the family.
Thank you, Chair. This hopefully helps you understand a little bit more of the contract to start with. Even perhaps that we're going to do more nutshell. That would be a good. Okay, I can send some different writing material down that help with this, that I can have it to this offline. But really quickly about the sovereign immunity and the liability aspect. So a sovereign can't be sued unless it consents to be sued, right? That's the principle that the tribe operates with, that the state of Alaska operates, and some of the tribes, because the tribes have tribal sovereign immunity. Now, an Indian tribe is federally recognized, does not have a full deck of cards, if you will, when it comes to sovereign immunity. It only possesses those attributes of sovereignty that the federal government says that it still does. And this goes back to early contacts and the way that the United States has dealt with federally recognized tribes, both through treaties and through executive orders, through huge Supreme Court cases, and the like. When it comes to the liability part, that's a separate issue because the state of Alaska is a joint and several liability state. That means if you have two actors that are involved in both acts, both of them could be brought into court if something goes wrong because of their partnership. So here we've got the state on one side, the tribes on the other, and a contract in the middle. If the state wants to decrease its liability for services that the tribes provide on its behalf, the easiest way to do that is to give the tribes more control. Because then the state, when it does in court, will say, well, I didn't have 50% control of that purchase. It was a 90-10 or something like that. And the state's liability will be decreased by the more responsibility that the tribes assume.
Just because I understand the legal jurisdiction aspect of this, if the child lives in, we call it a mixed family, one of the parents is a member of a tribe, the other is not, does the child automatically fall under the jurisdiction of the tribe?
As a people. Representative to the chair, that child needs to be eligible for enrollment. There are a lot of times when we will be indicative of whether or not their parent is enrolled. But every tribe defines its enrollment different, and you have to go to every individual tribe to see whether or not that child is eligible for enrollment and eligible, therefore, to be covered if the child is removed to see if the tribe would become involved.
Thank you, Senator Chair. I'm very intrigued by this whole thing, and as a mental health provider in Caribbean villages, you know, what are the piece of that, and how do we do this practice and services system? This piece of the 50%, 60% disparity, you said it seems to be related to poverty and not the segregation based on those just using Native children over non-Native children. Is that accurate to you? Reflect on what you just said.
Right, Chair. If you're asking whether or not OCS has a bias of removing Native children over non-Native children, I don't believe that that's how the agency approaches the work. So when you look at the data, you do have to reconcile that there are some differences. And yes, it starts from poverty because when you have a family that is not in a position to get enough food, enough bedrooms, enough clothes, or other basic essentials for their children, that is going to cause many poor schools to fall apart with the office of children services. And sometimes when OCS comes in, you do have a cultural conflict between what an OCS worker is seeing as maybe a sign of crisis or a problem and what a school's responsibility that is would see as a problem compared to a native child welfare worker who would understand that these children are all sleeping in the same bed together because that's their preference and that's what they want to do. It's not necessarily because the family is in crisis. That's just my example.
Thank you. I understand that very well. Seeing that cultural differences in living and having dressed as Christmas and the universal. So we're bringing it up. Modality of living and projecting into a different culture and saying you've got to do this, and then therefore making accusations that there's wrongfulness from really helps us living. You brought up that, and Sarah brought up that issue of data collection. So, is there currently a paradigm of what's expected in data collection so that you do a longitudinal study to this that we're not doing anecdotal type of studies? Opinions, but a lot of collection of such. Is that being done, or is there a paradigm for them?
Thank you. Yes, that is being done. And that's one of the drivers that the WV administration is running the system. And for good reason, right? We need to make sure that this is working and that the resources are spent in the most efficient and effective way possible. So we are starting to collect that data. But again, there have been some implementation challenges. So not all of the schools are functioning on all six cylinders, if you would at this point. But as they start to, and they get out of this pandemic, we did really implement a lot of these folks, and the world is going to like change rapidly because of COVID. So we're starting to collect that data in the midst of the pandemic.
So this data collection is an expectation that it's in the cost of review of you had 6 months, a year, whatever, because children don't stick around to be children. They grow up. And so what's our expectation of this community is going to see some data reports in the past 6 months or a year? Is that part of the paradigm to be able to understand? Or is it we'll find out in 3 years, 4 years, and we'll let you know? Or is that
on that? That representative assurance is really a good question on whether answered by OCS. But I will tell you they do track the number of children in day custody in all the post-service regions and service delivery areas. And they also are tracking how many folks referrals have been made. So it's a two-part issue, right? The state needs to make referrals to the tribes in all of these different areas for the initial and ongoing searches, the family contact, licensing assists, and safety evaluations. And then in turn, the tribes receive those referrals from the state, they do the work. So it's a two-part process. And we have had some difficulty with that first part being the referral coming out. And we've also had some problems with the tribes declining some of the referrals for different reasons, such as maybe this child is dually enrolled in different regions and another tribe is better equipped to handle this family for whatever reason. But yes, data is starting to be collected because we do understand the policy makers expect to see some measurable results, and the tribes and state through the Office of Children and Services is committed to collecting and providing that data. home and negotiate sort of a new set of agreements. But so there's a lot of challenges that impede things in the legislature. I mean, often folks want to see like major wholesale reforms and deliver massive results in 1 year or 2 years. And, you know, that's just not the way, you know, systemic change works. It takes time for systemic change to realize its whole result and embrace the fact that we all believe that it will. I think it's important that we see this as a long-term sort of, you know, restructuring, and that our benchmarks, you know, in the first few years would be just on a setting the floor, and then from there we'll grow. But I think that we're just constantly focusing on, think that, you know, the first benchmark should indicate success or failure, but actually, you know, just sort of the first step of many along the way as we continue to make progress.
Thanks. Okay, I've got that on the hard side.
Thank you, so I think for the first one, then you can represent possibly Virginia's false course being made to the winner to the scope of work that maybe is not applicable. But I think this is my answer to your question earlier, Kevin Chair. Caseworkers that are running for the tribe, they're part of the contract. You mentioned they may have a different way of doing things or evaluating. You know, we've said there's cultural differences in it, but I'm thinking, I have four wives, I have 3 months, he's 8 years old, and they often sleep in the same bed, and doesn't make me mad. I guess the question is, are the rules that are the same in terms of the decisions you make that the children have to be away from home, in terms of both the classes and court order? Is that kind of the same criteria that we're setting rules, or is there, I guess, green line fee?
Thank you, Representative.
Just the whole population
as a large. I'm not sure if you're talking about the
made a contribution in the States to the population of children?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. This is an explicit area of discussion here. So, my question is, how does this disparity, which is quite significant, compare in the United States with tribes and regions within the settlements? I mean, right now, it's kind of the first contact of this kind, but are we in the worst states? I mean, obviously, I think less tribes, but how do they compare their states on the introduced numbers?
Or it's happening with the contact, and that may be different than what we're
is if we want to make sure that evaluation is an integral and sustainable part of this effort.
Thank you. Yeah.
being Magnus from last week's conference. This matters if you could begin by introducing yourself, the marker of your affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Just that have Alaska tracks are confirmed to have personal jurisdiction, particularly in the area of domestic relations regarding trade matters in the absence of Indian country or reservation lands. These cases prove that Alaska tracks have jurisdiction over tribal members in protecting the health and safety of their tribal members even without land base of a reservation. Solutions are now emerging with multiple wise tribes in the state can work together in responding to these issues regarding child welfare and the tribal state welfare contract is one of those examples. Canada Chiefs Conference decided to become a co-signer on behalf of the British of individually recognized tribes in our region. And we provide technical support to our tribal governments as well as our families that are within the region that get involved with either the tribal or the state justice system. The support that we provide varies. Like Nicole Berman had mentioned, our tribes are all at different levels of capacity and infrastructure, so the level of support that Canada Chiefs Conference provides to each tribe is very different, depending on the level of their infrastructure and their ability to provide those services locally. We provide support in regards to social services and case management support on tribal court cases. Dual supervision meaning they are partly employed by Canada Chiefs Conference and partly employed by the tribal government. And these are the tribal social service workers that are located in their villages. In the Canada Chiefs Conference, their title is Tribal Family Youth Specialist, or the acronym is TFIS. It's a term you may hear often if you're working with a tribal. And we also provide support in tribal court facilitation, tribal foster care licensing and safety evaluation services for tribal family licensed foster homes, as well as provide equal advocacy and representation to tribes on cases that are in state court, as well as provide legal support for equal cases as requested by tribes. In regards to what is going on in the region, in the PCC region regarding child welfare, Canada Chiefs Conference has begun implementing a new data tracking software to serve the organization as well as the 37 tribes in our region to be able to view possible mentioning tracking that data and making sure that we're able to show really good measurable outcomes. And we are also finding that is an important need for both tribal court cases our tribes are handling, as well as the support they're providing in state cases. We've also had a family first prevention specialist. After the Family First Prevention Act was passed, we were excited to see that there is a direction nationally at looking at prevention and how to stop the system from being reactive and working to provide support to us at-risk families before there is a crisis. And so we have recently hired a position that will specifically focus on providing preventative services to those at-risk families. And we are also working at reorganizing tribal client services department that includes the services for social services, child welfare, to really make sure that we can promote family preservation and healing, as well as building our partners with outside agencies. We've been working very closely with Stevie's Place and the Alaska State Troopers, as well as the Office of Children's Services, to identify ways and improve response for having child advocacy centers for the rural communities due to the long time period for investigating our child sexual abuse cases. For our scopes under the contract, we are currently only operating under one scope, and that is the split scope of transition of taking on ATM scope and wanting to see on a body to have like a set checklist or some kind of structure kind of help out with the transition of ATM scope organization or trying to stick on. We do look at things in an innovative, traditional way, and also by having just basic guidelines, not those not a detailed list of policies, but just kind of giving that minimum expectation that needs to be met in kind of that checklist form. We've also kind of wanted to learn processes and getting our staff under the contract agreement quick access to the certain state programs that are needed to fulfill duties, and I kind of heard Nicole explain that there was some time frames where things were taking a while for the referrals to get out from OCS to the tribes, and so I'm hoping that those are things that will have just been lessons learned and that we won't continue to see challenges in regards to getting those different accesses and referrals out. One thing I mentioned before, I'm looking at challenges we face going forward, and I think this is a challenge for both our tribal and state partners, is having safe places in both urban and rural communities for family protective supervision. There is so much research that proves and shows that a child who gets to continue contact with their parent and family members through custody are more likely to reunify and more likely to be resilient once that happens. And that the less contact, the less visitation, the more likely that case is not going to end in reunification. So really, identifying ways that we can have that contact with our families. I did hear a question earlier regarding staff's capacity to really do all of the scopes of work under this agreement, and all one single staff person is completely maximized by one single scope. We are trying to find creative ways for other staff that are already doing other things to kind of include these duties. But funding really is needed for a program to take on additional scopes, even at Canada Teams Conference being a bigger region with more resources and more infrastructure. We still find that to take on all of these scopes without any increase in funding would be extremely challenging. But I don't necessarily see it as we're just replacing the service of OCS, because the service we are providing is completely different, even though it's meeting that expectation that OCS is required to provide of a family. It is very different, the service we're receiving. For example, a current diligent relative search person says that when she reaches out to families to get their family tree and their information to go back and share with OCS, that she's having these very great positive experiences. When you will speak to a random OCS caseworker that had to go and make those calls and do the searches, and they're getting hung up, and they're getting, you know, there's a difference when the service is being provided by the tribal organization instead of the state, partly because of the history that there is for certain tribal members. They still have trauma or experience distrust when it's the service provided by the state, even if it's a service to help their family. And so I think that this is a really important bridging opportunity. And that when we're looking at measurable outcomes, although obviously the dollar amount is extremely important, and making sure, you know, that money is being put into a service that is improving and providing a quality service, but also this is our state's future, our youth are our future, the future of the state depends on them, and so as we continue to pour into our youth, we should see that decrease in the state court systems, a decrease in the prison systems. And yes, those are all long systematic changes, but I do think that we will also see other
actually the blue, the old Romeo, as well as the new Orpheus and the new Midas. In closing, I think I would ask the one question of both Miss Orpheus and Miss Midas, if you could speak to Miss Orpheus, you mentioned that it's important for the state to commit to this partnership. Just in closing, can you touch on what that might look like? What does that commitment look like with respect to the Travel Channel of our contract?
Thank you for the question. Very quickly, to respond, we're looking to the state to be a partner in the compact, meaning not only building designing the framework in which the compact needs to be realizing, but also define our roles, define our responsibilities, and looking to the state also to make sure that both the tribes and the state can incorporate training, we have the appropriate policy, and of course the appropriate funding. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else from TCC's perspective, or are you able to speak to that? We still have you.
Yes. So, yes, coming to the table, being able to hear every Alaska Native tribe and also the Alaska State citizen in the West Bay, and so having that opportunity to have, it's just one more resource for the state to utilize for these families, and so really just being available and coming to the table and as well as considering the need for.
Okay, so again, I want to thank Director Quinn and Acting Deputy Director Halloran for joining us on the line today. We look forward to your presentations on Thursday. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be this Thursday, April 8th at 3 p.m. here in Day 106. You will be continuing on the theme of child welfare. The new Alaska Pediatric Partnership will be presenting their report, which is the Alaska Early Childhood Environmental Scan. Summer for the condition of young children. An electronic version of the report will be distributed, but many may have also received a physical copy of the federal electronic copy from A2PG earlier this year. We will also be hearing from my house, Matthew Holmes, speaking center, and again, the Office of Children's Services. The time is 4 to 7 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now.